And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On today's show, we are finally shattering our silence on Breaking Bad, which we've talked about but never really talked about, and now we will. Then we'll tackle a question from our Facebook page about works of art and culture that get raves at first, but then later, nobody will admit they ever liked them. Titanic, this one is for you. We'll do a little bit of business about the show, and then we will close, as always, with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I am the movies editor for NPR.org.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, I'm awfully happy to see everybody. It's good to have you all here. Now, Breaking Bad.
Yes.
As we tape this, it is Monday, and the season premiere was last night, Sunday. And as you may know, if you've been listening to the show for a while, several of us have talked at various times about our difficulties getting into this show, or our failure to get into this show, or in Glenn's case, our binging on this show, or in Mike Katzeff's case, our esteemed producer, being smart enough to be in on this show largely from the beginning. So we did think we would chat about it a little bit today. Now, for those of you who don't watch Breaking Bad, the basic layout is Walter White is a chemistry teacher who, after being diagnosed with cancer, and this is all premise stuff, this is all first episode stuff, after being diagnosed with cancer, has a need for a lot of money and also clearly some other problems, and gradually becomes involved in manufacturing meth, and picks up as his associate a former student of his who has become a kind of small-time meth cook, whose name is Jesse. He also has a wife whose name is Skylar. He has a son who only shows up at breakfast, whose name is Walter Jr. So that's the basic setup. If you don't watch the show, that's kind of where we're starting. I do want to recognize the efforts of Stephen and Trey, both of whom, as I understand it, you guys both did a little crashing last night.
We did I did a little mainlining of the first five episodes of season one.
Oh, nice. A little little binging, and now a little purging.
So, Stephen, you watched the first three of the first season.
Yeah, so what I did was I decided, well, it's going to be this wacky experiment. I'm going to watch the very first episode of the show, because my mom had given me the first season on DVD and been like, watch this dummy, and then I never did.
The way other people's mothers would give them vitamins.
Here's an incredibly violent TV drama. Enjoy! But I figured I would watch the first episode, and then I would watch the season premiere last night, and just sort of see if I was able to follow the latter.
There are a few things that happened in the middle.
Change in hairstyle.
Yeah. 3.5 intervening seasons.
Right. And so, well, part of that, though, was the idea of, Linda, you've written about this on the blog, of jumping into shows midstream.
Mm-hmm.
And is this a show where you can jump in midstream and be able to follow it? So I wanted to test that. The answer is not really.
I was going to say, this is not a great example of a show that I would argue you can jump into midstream.
Like, it's not like jumping in halfway through Everybody Loves Raymond.
Well, sure. I was going to say, when I have had that fist fight with some of your AV Club fellas, it's been more about other shows. It's been shows that are maybe a little bit less reliant on gigantic, massive plot
reversals,
swings.
Yeah.
Well, and more to the point, I mean, and I read an interview with Vince Gilligan, the creator of the show, about how he wanted this show to be about the characters changing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That, you know, that so many shows are about static, and where the narrative imperative is to, at the end of each episode, sort of leave the characters back where they started.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, he radically changes between the first episode.
And you can tell if you've only seen the first three and then last night.
What I ended up doing was I watched the first episode and was just dumbstruck by how great I thought it was.
Did you? Were
yeah,
you?
I just thought it was fantastic. Just
really
completely
just
gripping.
Just from that opening shot of the pants flying in the air, you're like, okay, you what's happening here?
And he's in the RV.
Yeah, he's in the RV. There's the pants fly up in the air, and you're like, okay, this is good television. Like, I know this is going to be good television. I also like the fact that it's funny.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's willing to be a little funny.
And
that's something I never thought this show would
be. Absolutely.
Yeah,
I think the fact that they chose Bryan Cranston, who was a guy who largely was known, Malcolm in the Middle, he was on Seinfeld. A lot of the stuff people knew him from was absolutely comedy.
Well, and not only comedy, but sort of face-pulling comedy.
Absolutely. And so one of the things that I love about that show, and I don't know to what degree, last night's was not a great episode for this, but when you inevitably get sucked into finishing the rest of the series, whenever he runs or does anything physical, it's still funny. He still runs like a dad. I mean, he still runs like a, and I don't mean to say like real dads can't be graceful, but like a movie dad.
Right.
He still runs like Bryan Cranston would be in Malcolm in the Middle almost. Like whenever you see him doing anything physical, he hasn't suddenly acquired the grace of a jungle cat or something.
Well,
and that
creates the tension that you get between sort of his old life and his new life once he has decided to break bad.
When you talk about jumping in and then jumping all the way to the end, on the one hand, you obviously can't figure out what's going on at all. But on the other hand, you can kind of tell the broad arc of the character, and perhaps of several of the characters, that by the time we come to last night's show, and obviously, if you haven't figured out by now that you should not be listening to this, if you don't want to know, understand that now. By the time you get to last night's episode, you can tell that his wife has become much more complicit. And, you know, his wife, who was originally completely in the dark about all of this, has become complicit.
Yeah, where you feel like in the beginning, it's almost like a wacky misadventure. Like she mishears and thinks it's this, you know.
I have to say, though, having watched those first four episodes and watched her interactions with him and with the kid and with her sister, I think that part of her character is there from the very beginning.
Yeah, I agree.
You see enough of her selfishness and her grasping qualities. Not that she's deeply unpleasant, but there's just enough of that to make it not a terrible surprise that she's ended up where she is now.
And it's no less plausible that she would become complicit than it is that he would get involved in it.
Right. I mean, she reads to me a lot like Carmela Soprano.
Yeah.
And Stephen, did you see, as I tried to make the point last week, that in the first episode, you see flashes of his imperiousness, his rationalization, which he becomes over the course of the series. He becomes that. And I remember thinking in just the first few flashes of the way he treats Jesse, there is this really condescending unkindness, but there's still a bond there, and that's what the series plays with. In interviews about this show, Vince Gilligan keeps saying that he wants this to be the transition from Mr. Chips, the science teacher, to Scarface, which on the surface sounds really cool, and you think, well, he's just picking two random pop culture icons. I want to show about the incredible Mr. Limpet to Serpico. You can do it. You know, Bullwinkle to Mr. Belvedere. But you see,
I would totally watch that show.
I would watch that show too. There is in this show, you know, it gets dinged for its nihilism. It's sort of depressing. Anything can happen. There is a really implacable Old Testament morality to this show.
Absolutely.
That transgressions get punished
transgressions have meanings.
Right.
This is one thing that I noticed from the first few episodes. I was watching the first few episodes and thinking about what my mom had said when she was talking about how much she loved the show. She's like, there are these amazing scenes where they're dealing with trying to dispose of a body.
Yep.
And it's not done in the pat way that bodies are dealt with in movies. They're messy. They're heavy.
Right.
The logistics of disposing of a corpse is just, there are gigantically complicated.
Yeah. And in fact, the body disposal stuff, I mean, we all sort of have had different trajectories with this show. Mine was a couple years ago, probably, I started and watched like the first three or four. And to me, the body disposal stuff was awfully hard to watch.
Wow.
And I just got to the point where it wasn't that I didn't like it, and it wasn't like, this is distasteful, I refuse to watch this. It felt like work for that reason. And I just kind of didn't get back to it for a long, 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 long time. Now, then I pushed through that. I got a couple more episodes in, and I was fine, and I was done, and I gobbled up the rest of it, you know, joyfully, and recently finished the whole series. But the reason why I love that, in retrospect, that body disposal stuff is that that's how, almost right away, because it goes so wrong and they have to get rid of one guy's body and ultimately kill the other guy, the two of them are bonded forever.
Forever.
And they can't sort of it off.
Walter White and Jesse.
And they can't sort of say, like, this is way worse than I expected, because now you've killed a guy.
Yeah.
You've killed two guys. And you've disposed of bodies. And now you've done this horrible thing, and now you're sort of inexorably intertwined. And one of the things you'll see as you watch the show, without spoiling it for you, because I really do hope that you'll continue.
I actually will.
Is that their relationship is sort of constantly shifting. And one of the things I've spoken about with my friend Alan Sepinwall, who, if you read Alan, you know that he's done a tremendous amount of analysis of Breaking Bad. But one of the things that we've talked about is how, at the beginning, you sort of get the sense that Walt is sort of falling in with Jesse, and that Walt is sort of being kind of corrupted because he's falling in with Jesse. But as the series goes on, and certainly by the time you're looking at last night's episode, it's very clear that Jesse probably would have remained kind of a small-time meth cook and might have eventually straightened his life out. And what really happened is that Jesse got sucked into this much more massive problem because he got sucked in with Walt.
Watching the very first episode, my initial reaction to Jesse was, boy, this... You know, you've got this great actor who's giving this sort of booming actorly performance and these scenes of, you know, actor on actor acting. and then you've got sort of dopey Jesse. And about halfway through the first episode, all of a sudden you get this flash with Jesse. The actor's name is Aaron Paul, and he's so freaking good.
This is another thing that I noticed as I was watching it, is that Jesse, there are about five different Jessies as the show goes on. He goes through several major evolutions, and you get a different guy about every half a season. You get a whole different kid, and you're gonna love it. You're gonna love it. I absolutely promise you, you're gonna
Can't
love
wait.
It. As much as I, Stephen, I'm gonna invite you to continue watching the show, but because our esteemed producer Mike Katziff is the person on the panel who has actually been up on this show from the beginning, it's not a Johnny Come Lately. We are going to kick you out.
Absolutely.
And we're going to give Mike your spot for a little bit.
Well, you know what? I'm still going to listen.
You should.
You can't stop me, Linda Holmes.
You should. Mike Katziff.
Hi.
It's always good to see you.
Thank you.
Esteemed producer.
Thank you.
Did you watch the show from the very beginning?
Mostly from the beginning. I think I missed those first six episodes, but I remember when that debuted because I was watching Mad Men at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You could tell from these crazy trailers, this might be a show I'm going to like. And granted, like, I love shows like The Wire,
yes,
The Sopranos, mm-hmm, Mad Men, Deadwood, all these very prestige, gritty, sort of long arc.
It has Katziff written all over it more than it has Linda Holmes written all over it. Although I absolutely love it.
That said, I mean, I would completely agree that those first six episodes sort of drop you in that deep end, and it's so grim and so dour right from the get-go that you have to push through that. And I think they do that on purpose.
I think so, too.
I mean, if you look at how that first season of The Wire is, or the first season of Sopranos, they just assume that you will catch up.
Yeah.
And so this show, while the scope starts very small for the most part, it's more or less that the family and a few other characters, they drop you into that uber-violence very quickly.
Right.
And then it sort of becomes one of those things where the little things in between those hyper bursts of violence are the things that eventually grab you. So these very quiet scenes, these scenes where he's just by himself making a facial expression or alone with his desperation and thoughts and
curling up asleep on the bathroom floor.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Those are the things that wrap inside of you, those scenery scenes of the mountains in Albuquerque in New Mexico, almost function the way that in Friday Night Lights those scenery scenes do. And so there's this pacing that sort of seeps into your blood while you're watching.
The setting's very important, and my understanding is originally it was supposed to be set in California, and I think they wound up setting it in Albuquerque because they wound up having the opportunity to shoot it in Albuquerque.
Yeah.
That's my understanding of how it went. But you get that, like, American West kind of look because that's where they are. California looks like everything, I understand. But I do think there's something about setting it in a place that's not California,
and
a place that's a little flatter.
Probably
a
very
little
good call, because you've already got weeds set in California.
Mm-hmm. Sure. By sending it there, I think you can see the effects. Sort of like in Winter's Bone, you see the effects of the drugs everywhere. Everything from, like, the victims, the people who are using, to the dealers, and it builds and builds and builds all the way up to the Mexican cartels.
Right.
And you see as it, you know, just like The Wire, it pulls the camera back more and more to, like, reveal, like, how much is really at stake. It's not just, like, people selling drugs.
Right.
It really connects to so many things.
And as Glenn was saying before, it's something where actions have consequences.
Right. Yeah. And the show that this gets compared to a lot is The Sopranos, except that show had an arc, but had a very different one. It had a screwed-up monster start off, and over the course of the series, he becomes a better-functioning, more mentally healthy monster.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of change there. What happens is that because of his therapy, he's able to deal with it a little bit better.
It validates.
One of our interns, incidentally, wrote a great piece about how Tony Soprano didn't really change. It's not really a tragic...
Right.
He just kind of stays the same.
Well,
it's a terrific piece. Yeah.
You know, he's the son, and everyone else is sort of rotating around
him. Absolutely. Exactly. Whereas this is much more of a change of a character over time.
Glenn was talking about the movement from one type of character to another type of character and the choice of those two characters as archetypes. I was talking to a film professor earlier today at lunch, and we were talking about this, about the show, and he said that for him, the iconic character that keeps coming to mind is Dr. Frankenstein. Not Frankenstein's monster, but Dr. Frankenstein, who, much like Walter, pursues these dangerous things out of hubris. I mean, Walter is motivated in part by money, but he's also motivated in part by pride in the chemistry he can do.
And as you will see, as you watch more of it, money
becomes less and less.
Money
of a thing.
Becomes less and less.
That was almost like the Band-Aid ripping off and
that was kind of what
there's this gigantic wound.
That was kind of what pushed him to start to explore all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But that's not really why he turns out to kind of love.
And he has many opportunities to get out and can't. His ego gets in the way to the point where he wants the credit and he wants more and more power.
Right. And even based on what I've seen so far, it's pretty clear that he's going to make a string of decisions thinking he's doing the smart thing or the clever thing or the necessary thing.
Or just the necessary thing.
But he's not going to be able to see the potential consequences.
And the question becomes, as you watch the show, you'll see, and those of you who have watched it know this, he has a couple of sort of along the way big moments where he makes big choices. And you sort of have these feelings of like, gadunk, like he's dropped another rung into all of this. And they always really recognize the gravity of those moments. And if you track the series, it's not one of those things where they're constantly trying to shock you with another more terrible thing. It's over the whole course of the series, it's like three or four things, I would say, where you feel like everything was different after he did this.
Yeah.
Everything was different after
that slippery slope where as soon as you do one thing, then you have to make cleanup for that. And to clean up that decision leads to this, and this.
And I think what Glenn was talking about the morality, that's part of it too. Yeah.
I talked this weekend with my 22 and 20-year-old nephews about this show, and they love it. And it occurred to me as we were discussing the show that they love it for all the wrong reasons. They love it because they like to see Walter White being a badass. And I was about to get up on my high horse.
There is that.
And then I realized, I love this show for all the wrong reasons. I love those moments too.
Well, sure, you root, just like you root for Tony Soprano or Don Draper, you root for him, but at the same time, even when he succeeds, it's horrible things that he's succeeding at.
That's right.
And in last night's episode, in the premiere, they're more or less pulling off a heist of sorts. Evidence has been sort of found that will implicate them, as this seems to occur over and over and over again. We want to make sure we don't get caught, so we have to do X thing, whether it's kill someone or take out some sort of security camera, whatever it is. And just the decision of them pulling off this heist is going to lead to the arc that's going to happen
later on. And I think, too, when you talk about kind of being able to in a way, root for him and in a way kind of enjoy him being a badass, that to me is one of the reasons why the development of the character of Jesse is so important. By putting Jesse with him all the time and by tying them together, I think it creates some of those big decisions that he makes have terrible consequences for Jesse. And so I think, unlike Tony Soprano, who, you know, who he was affecting other than himself always seemed like kind of a bunch of other, like, mob guys and stuff like that. And he was affecting sort of family members who you didn't necessarily have a ton of sympathy for either. I think with Jesse, by building so many vulnerabilities into that kid and by giving him so many problems and by making it so clear, like I was saying, that he sort of was doomed by falling in with Walter, I think the character of Jesse is there to make it impossible for you not to come to grips with the seriousness of some of the stuff that he does.
Sure. I mean, you see Jesse throughout being the heart of that relationship and heart of the show in a lot of ways, even though he's also doing, in some cases, equally terrible things. But he always feels like he has no choice, or he's doing it because he eventually cares for Walter. And actually, Walter, in a lot of ways, cares for him, even though Walter does awful things.
Mm-hmm. Jesse's less motivated by a desire to become powerful.
I think that's right. He's sort of a survivalist, I think. He keeps falling into drug use himself. It was very clear up until a very specific part, I think, in the end of the third season. He had not done any of the killing. Walter had kept that from him very specifically. And then when that happens, that leads him to
a— that's another one of those big sort of like boom. Mm-hmm. And you just— I love that performance. Aaron Paul, I love that performance. Bryan Cranston's won a bunch of Emmys and they're all deserved. And I don't have any problem with all of his awards. And Aaron Paul has won also.
Sure. He won one last year.
In supporting,
But let's mention a really smart addition to the show, which is Jonathan Banks, who plays Mike.
You bet.
Yeah.
The competing father figure for Jesse's, not necessarily affections. Neither one of these guys, neither Mike nor Walt, has Jesse's best interest, quote-unquote, at heart.
Right.
But Mike is coming from a different sort of purer place, a less nuanced place.
Yeah, I mean, Mike, for people who don't know, he's working more or less for this businessman who turns out to be a high-powered cartel drug ring leader. And midway through, I would guess, in the fourth season, he sort of takes Jesse under his— under his wing.
He becomes, as Walt and Jesse are working with this kind of big boss, they also come—
they keep trying to drive this wedge between the two of them, and so they take Jesse under his wing, and Jesse really starts to grow and thrive in that situation. Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting in this season, now that that threesome is now Walt and Mike and Jesse sort of playing in between. Right. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
It's not going to end well for Mike.
It's not going to end well for anyone. That's let's true. Be real.
But also, the guy who plays Mike, Jonathan Banks, here's a guy who's been around forever. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of Matlocks under this guy's belt. There's a lot of Walker, Texas Rangers. And it's great whenever an actor like that gets a moment to shine like this.
Absolutely. And the whole history of this show is populated by a bunch of people who have given fantastic performances in a bunch of different roles, large and small. Yeah. Giancarlo Esposito just left the show lately and did some great work. Kristen Ritter, who is now on Don't Trust the Bee in Apartment 23, did some fine work on the show herself.
I would say this show in Justified loves the character actor in a way... writes amazing parts.
Oh, my God, and Bob Odenkirk. I forgot to
say that. Oh, my God. Bob Odenkirk's amazing. And just this weekend, they were sort of hinting. Vince Gilligan more or less said, I would love to see a spinoff with just Saul, played by Bob Odenkirk.
I really—
who knows if that actually happens?
Say,
that would be so
if
cheesy.
If that means that nobody's going to kill Saul, I would feel so much better.
Yeah.
I've told Sepinwall, I'm like, whoever kills Saul, that's my enemy for life. That's— if anybody kills Saul, then we're done forever.
And it's so off-type for someone like Bob Odenkirk, too.
Yeah, that's been also a terrific performance. And, you know, Stephen mentioned comedy, and you don't bring Bob Odenkirk on without being completely comfortable with mixing a large amount of comedy with what you're bringing to
the
table.
He's such a cheesy shyster.
So I think what we should do is hopefully we will continue to talk about this show a little bit more as hopefully Stephen and Trey continue to watch it, and as this run of 8 episodes continues, and then there will be another 8 episodes next summer, because we're dragging it out forever, and then it will be over. So I think we should continue to have these conversations because this show is awesome.
It really is. I'm glad you guys finally got
into it. There's way more than this, and there's way more than this to say about it. But
I'm seeing a lot of sleepless nights in my future.
Even Steven, I'm going to make him watch it because it's awesome, and he's going to love it, and we're going to keep him going.
Just take a bunch of meth and just tank right through.
All right,
don't endorse this.
Come and talk to us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/PCHH, and tell us whether you like Breaking Bad or don't like Breaking Bad. Boo. And come talk to us on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. Leave us your comments because we are very curious. Hey, look who's back in his spot.
Hey.
Stephen Thompson. Well, we do want to thank Mike Katzeff for sitting in on our Breaking Bad segment as a person who's watched the show.
And actually knowing things.
But we are welcoming Stephen back for our next segment. Now, this topic came to us from our Facebook friend, Tanya Barber, who talked about some of the movies. Specifically, I think she was talking mostly about movies, but it really applies to everything, where things are released or first come to familiarity and everybody's all excited about them and they get perhaps great reviews or great acclaim of other kinds.
Win gigantic awards.
Gigantic amounts of awards, and then 10 years later, you find that everybody seems to remember hating them. You know, we've talked about this with, obviously, Titanic, to me, one of the classic examples. If you go and you actually look up the reviews of Titanic, it is not fiction that at the time it got absolutely stellar reviews, not just from Roger Ebert, but from Elvis Mitchell and Stanley Kaufman and Owen Gleiberman and critics from the Baltimore Sun and the AV Club and Newsweek and USA Today and the Chicago Tribune. And those are just the ones that were 90 or 100 listed that way on Metacritic. So these are the excellent ones.
And it raked in, 12 Oscar nominations, tied for the record, I think?
Absolutely.
Best Picture, King of the World. I think the King of the World thing started to create...
It
not only the scene in the movie, but James Cameron
when he did
the
it.
Oscar.
Yeah, when he did it at the Oscars.
So we are kind of jumping ahead, but this is the topic: is this kind of work? And Stephen, I wanted to go to you first because you had one that you wanted to mention that doesn't come from movies.
The first thing that I thought of when this topic came up, we immediately went to a bunch of movies that won Best Picture. What jumped out at me was a record that came out 20 years ago, which it was the number one album of the year on the Village Voice Pazenjop Critics Poll. It won 2 Grammys, including Best New Artist. It seemed almost unanimously viewed as the absolute future of music. This is a heritage artist we will be talking about for decades to come.
This is a Coldplay, right?
The group is Arrested Development, not to be confused with the television show that has dwarfed it even in people's memories. Arrested Development was a high-minded hip-hop group that crossed over massively, sold 4 million copies of its debut album, 3 years, 5 months, and 2 days in the life of ... spawned 3 top 10 singles in Tennessee, Everyday People and Mr. Wendell, and was followed 2 years later by an album which I insist to this day, nobody remembers this. This was a rapturously received record when it
the
came out.
The second one.
The second one. It is called Zingala Maduni. and it is now synonymous.
I love that. That's a song from The Lion King.
It is now synonymous. Same year. It is now synonymous with just garbage. And I will tell you, I have not always been right in terms of, you know, getting these things right the first time. I was reviewing records then for the AV Club, and I wrote a review of Zingala Maduni that basically said it was a gigantic turd. It is a terrible record. It is a self-important pant load of just condescending, tuneless garbage. It's a terrible record. But, like, I remember...
So, wait, you liked it or you didn't like it?
And I remember, like, 4 stars in Rolling Stone, Entertainment Weekly gave it an A, and there was this whole discussion of, like, their rocket ride to super-duper stardom.
So you feel like with this record, it's a matter of the fact that it was always bad, and people have just come around to the idea of...
Well, I think with Zingala Maduni, that's the case. I think that 3 years, 5 months, and 2 days in the life of is a fine record. It's very dated now. It became dated very quickly because it fit very well in sort of early 90s hyper-earnestness.
Okay.
That, you know, your Four Non Blondes and your, you know, any number of, you know...
I was very earnest in the early 90s.
I was earnest myself in the early 90s, too. It was just that time, you know. But it was very much a record that put a very safe face on hip-hop without shying away from sort of the important issues of the day.
So you feel like that one was one where certain qualities that it possessed that were not destined to last made it seem at the time much more important than it was.
Correct. And it's also a case, and I think we're going to talk about this with a few of these examples. It's also something where it once stood on a precipice or once stood at a fork in the road, and it could go one way or it could go the other. And it went the way of its absolute worst tendencies. Mm-hmm. And Arrested Development immediately went the way of all of its worst tendencies.
Yeah. Hmm.
The kind of preachiness and self-importance and self-seriousness, and clearly sort of bought into its own hype, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. Well, now, when we talked about this over email, the example that Glenn had mentioned was sort of this run of Best Picture winners, yeah?
Yeah. Right around the turn of the millennium, there was a bunch back-to-back Oscar winners, which right now, when you look back, have become punchlines. The first one, of course, was The English Patient, which became a punchline on Seinfeld the same year, pretty much, right?
Buffy the Vampire Slayer, too.
Exactly. It beat out Fargo, which is a crime. Followed that by Titanic, which again beat out L.A. Confidential, I think a much better film, but now is widely received as sort of mawkish and sentimental and over the top. This is going to be controversial. Followed by Shakespeare in Love.
I will go to the last battlement over this one.
Okay. All right.
Trey, I think that's your NPR showing.
I don't think with Shakespeare in Love it's as much
we hate Shakespeare in Love.
It's more why did it beat Saving Private Ryan?
Exactly. It's why did it beat Saving Private Ryan, and it's collateral Paltrow damage.
Well,
I don't know about that. It's also the fact that Judi Dench won for, what, 8 minutes?
She won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress for 8 minutes on
screen. For Best Cameo, yes.
That's right. And also, Trey, I think if you look back at that, it's a very light little piece of froth, but you know,
that movie also has a certain amount of Weinsteinian bad will.
There is.
Well, yeah, yeah.
Because
it was all about the campaign.
To clarify, Harvey Weinstein... Mm-hmm. You know, Oscar campaign. It was campaign sort of an
brutally
sort of an early example of the artist was like, there are a million movies. The King's Speech was like this, you know, where it seems like every year you can boost up the odds of anything with the Weinsteins.
I'm just going to say, though, leave aside Gwyneth Paltrow, who I think is charming in the movie,
she's
but
fine.
A lot of people don't like her. Leave aside Judi Dench, who is fantastic in the movie, but she's in it for 8 minutes. Leave aside Joseph Fiennes, who's
great.
Who's terrific, but some people think he's like Mooney and brown-eyed.
But you can be great still, Mooney and brown-eyed.
Sure, that still gives you Jeffrey Rush, Simon Callow, Colin Firth, Imelda Staunton, Tom Wilkinson, Jim Carter, and, Ben Affleck. Mm. Beyond that, it is a light movie, but it's a really sophisticated riff on both history and language. And there are so many delicious Shakespeare inside jokes.
Oh, that's my point. It's Shakespeare fan service. It's like, that's a reference to Twelfth Night.
But it doesn't. Those things do not get in the way of the storytelling because it's Tom Stoppard who
of course,
punched
up
the script.
This is your reflexive Anglophilic Stoppard fanboy.
Tom Stoppard is checked.
Now, see, when I look back at a bunch of these movies, there are certain ones that I
let's cover American Beauty, Gladiator, Crash.
Right. Yeah. Let's pause here at American Beauty, which is the quintessential example
of
this.
Okay. Oh, I'm absolutely. Just going to say I never liked American Beauty.
I never liked it either.
I thought American Beauty was pompous as all get out from the very beginning. I never got it. I came out of that movie. I was like, ooh, a bag. That's so artistic.
I like that movie, too. Mike off mic just said he likes the movie. I liked it when it came out. Haven't seen it since.
I thought it was so... And it's the whole thing of like, oh, because he's the terrible, mean
all
guy.
All conservatives are abusive, repressed homosexual Nazis. That's the message of the film.
I just felt... And I remember the other reaction that I had to it was that Annette Bening performance, which I felt was such a bunch of scenery chomping beneath her sort of.
Have to go watch this again now.
My reaction to that was this is what passes for giving a good role to an actress over about 30.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because I felt like if this is what she has to do for people to be like, wow, she's a really good actress, she is a pretty good actress.
Yeah.
But it was kind of this manic, weird. I hated that movie. From the
so that wasn't a Weinstein.
And also Gladiator, which is also terrible. Well, Gladiator is terrible. Gladiator is mystery science theater material, as far as I'm concerned.
American Beauty beat Insider, which is where some of my misgivings are coming from. It Gladiator beat Crouching Tiger, a movie I loved.
Yeah, yeah.
But the other one we want to talk about a little bit is Crash, because I do think there was a
that one people hated at the time.
Did they?
Yeah, because I felt everybody I knew hated that movie.
The reviews were more mixed. I went and looked at the reviews of a bunch of these movies today. And the reviews for that one were a little more mixed from the beginning. What I did find, some of the ones that I thought about are ones where what eventually caught up with them, and this is not as true of American Beauty, it's certainly not true of Gladiator, was a certain amount of mockery of their earnestness, as Stephen was saying. This is something that very much happened to Good Will Hunting. It's something that very much happened to Dead Poets Society, believe it or not.
Oh, yeah.
You say, oh, God,
I hated that.
Go back. But what I'm saying is there
the reviews
were
for
great
that movie
reviews.
Were rapturous.
Pauline Kael gave that movie like an absolute tongue bath, right? It happened to Jerry Maguire. It tends to happen a fair amount these kind of very sort of inspirational, feel-goody kind of...
Is this backlash, or is this just the natural cycle of embrace and rejection?
I know that one well.
Okay. Well, one of the unifying threads throughout this discussion, in most of these cases, these are movies that were nominated for, in most cases, one Best Picture. Mm-hmm. And I think, to a certain extent, you have success breeding contempt. Mm-hmm. And sort of whatever is the movie of the day, spawning a million references, show me the money, etc., to the point where these things become cartoonish
ubiquity,
in our minds.
Ubiquity, especially with anything that is supposed to be earnest or uplifting, is a terrible, terrible
thing. I don't think you get this happening with films like we were talking about Sarah Polley earlier. Think about Go. Think about Away From Her, both attached to Sarah Polley, one she starred in, one she directed.
Go is great, by the way.
Go is a great movie.
Great movie.
But it's dark, right? It's dark and a dark comedy.
Right.
So there was no backlash with that movie. Everybody still loves it. Same with Away From Her. It's depressingly sentimental, not upliftingly or earnestingly.
But that's the wrong variable. We're talking here about ubiquity. Ubiquity is the thing that does this.
Yeah. Well,
Go never achieved that.
I mean, here's a hypothetical, and I'm putting this out. This is one of my favorite movies of all time, if not my favorite movie of all time, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Mm-hmm.
If Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind had won Best Picture, would there be a backlash against it?
I think if it had worked its way more into pop culture, because that still remained...
If it had been the English Patient, it
still remained a little bit of kind of an offbeat picture.
I think it got like maybe a screenplay nomination.
But
it was
there,
not a...
What tends to happen, I think it happened to Titanic. I think this is another one that I would say, again, about Good Will Hunting is one that comes up for me, is that the only thing anymore that anybody remembers about that movie is that it's most pitched over-the-top sentimental stuff, namely the therapist stuff with him and Robin Williams and the crying and all that stuff, which the first time you see it can be kind of effective and it's fine. And it's in the context of a movie 75% of which is dudes talking to each other.
Right.
And those are the parts of that movie that I genuinely still love and think are great. Those guys hanging around, I think there is still some fantastic stuff in that movie. When you see a bunch of times, including in award clips and reels, that kind of, it's not your fault, and the crying and all that stuff.
Right.
Or when you see I'm the King of the World a million times, I think it begins to grate. And I think that's a different phenomenon from something like American Beauty, which I personally think what happened with American Beauty was partly that the drumbeat of how great it was so overwhelming. Because you talk about great reviews, they were like almost unanimous. Mm. The drumbeat of great reviews for that, people just didn't talk about it if they didn't like it. People just kind of were afraid that maybe it would seem like they didn't get it. So I think that was one where just people grew in confidence later in the ability to say, oh, you know what? I didn't like it.
Yeah, once a few people stand up and say it. But I mean, I think there is a certain amount of backlash against hubris. We talked about I'm the King of the World, particularly James Cameron's yelling I'm the King of the World when he won his Oscar.
Mm-hmm. This happens to Sorkin, too, I should say. It really does. Every time he opens his mouth, this hurts his stuff, too.
Yeah. One thing I wonder, another hypothetical, what if Avatar had won Best Picture instead of The Hurt Locker?
Mm-hmm.
How much more, you know, and I haven't heard people talk about Avatar recently. I know it was kind of a little bit more mixed when it came out.
Yeah.
But wouldn't there be like 10 times as much hatred of that movie today
if it had won
Best Picture?
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're probably right.
I think these things all fall victim to sort of different kinds of issues.
Can I follow Stephen down the road of a non-movie? In 1858, there was in 1858, Paris was absolutely scandalized by a satirical operetta by Jacques Offenbach, which introduced a piece called The Infernal Galop, or The Galop Infernal. It was a blistering satire of the music of Gluck, and it was set literally in hell. It was the talk of the town because it was too risque. It then later became associated with a different kind of risque performance, and now it is a comedy trope. If you think about every time you've seen a cartoon or a gangster comedy where some guy is on the run and he ends up backstage and then he ends up in a chorus girl's outfit and then he ends up somehow on stage lifting his skirts and swinging his leg while the orchestra goes da 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 da. That's the piece of music that in 1858 was a gigantic scandal and was taken very seriously and was a serious piece of art. And now it's a punchline. You can't hear it without seeing those things in your head.
Mm-hmm. I think that's almost exactly what happened to Gladiator.
Right. Which is also based on Gluck.
If you have things you would like to talk about that started off serious and were turned into punchlines, come and find us on Facebook or at the blog, facebook.com/PCHH or npr.org/PCHH. We are everywhere. Okay, before we get to our final segment of the show and talk about what's making us happy this week, we have to do a little bit of business. When Stephen and I decided to try to do this podcast a couple years ago, our original concept, which we came to in Stephen's living room, was that it should be called Pop Culture Happy Hour. It should consist of me, Stephen, Trey, Graham, and Glenn Weldon sitting around talking.
Hadn't even met Glenn.
No, Stephen had not met Glenn yet.
I
had met Glenn maybe two or three times, but we knew that we wanted Glenn, and the key discovery was that we could get Mike Katziff to produce it, because otherwise it's really just a bunch of people talking, which we do when we go and have drinks. So whenever you have a collaboration of five people like that, you always run the risk that somebody will go on to new opportunities. And so this is our last podcast altogether, because I'm going away at the end of this week and I'll be gone for a couple weeks.
You're coming back, though.
I'm coming back. But by the time I get back, Mike Katziff, our esteemed producer, will have moved on to new opportunities. Mike, do you want to tell the people what you're doing?
So I am taking a new producer job at WNYC, where I will be serving as their web producer for the music show Soundcheck.
WNYC is in New York?
Yeah, it is. I hate to say.
Oddly enough.
Unfortunately, it is. You know, I mean, you guys have heard us speak many times about how critical Mike is to all the work that we do here, but I personally felt that it was very important to get an actual taste of Mike's life producing our show. So I went all the way back to, it's episode 17. It's the 17th episode we ever taped.
Are we getting an outtake?
We are getting a little bit of outtake
material. We're all wearing monocles.
We were at the very end of the show. When I say we were at the very end of the show, I mean I had already given out the Twitter handles. I had already called out the music. I had already done just about everything. And then this happened. So I'm going to have Mike play a little bit for you. And that's it for this week on Pop Culture Happy Hour. So yeah.
that should be your new tagline. So, yeah.
All right, hang on. I'm sorry. I will do that again.
So, yeah. Should be the new tagline.
There's two. So, yeah.
So, yeah.
Leads you out.
Seacrest out. It is the new Seacrest out.
Oh, my God. It's 1,000 degrees in here, people. I have to leave. Get this done. This is how I was the other day when the pet petter came through.
The other day, also known as 8 minutes ago.
Oh, no.
Don't worry, when it seems, Mike, like the show is 80 minutes long, that a lot of it will not actually be included.
It's only 75.
Oh, my God.
I'm so sorry.
I think.
Ready?
That's the Lord telling us that's how it should end. That's what it's clearly.
Oh, I'm so sorry, I'm not doing it on purpose.
You can just do this again tomorrow. Oh my God.
So that brings us to the end of another Pop Culture Happy Hour, and we will see everybody next week.
That was it?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
You got everything else.
I'm sorry. Yes. It happens every time I do that, and then I cry at the end. So here's what you should know about that. That's a condensed version.
Oh, my God.
That went on for a little over 4 minutes. Wow. Was the original. I had Mike cut it down a little bit. It's not always easy being Mike. And in that situation, that taping, I should mention, had already gone on for an hour and 15 minutes at the time that was happening, and everybody really wanted to go home. So the point I'm trying to make is that not only does Mike direct us and help us stay on task, but Mike also takes gigantic swaths of messy nonsense and condenses them into...
Well, then let's pause for a moment. Cutting that down for the actual show... Not as difficult. You just delete the long stretches of whatever that was. The parts that humongously stand out for me are when I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning after a taping and think, I said this.
I'm going to get fired
and pitchforks and tar and feathers. And then I forget. I go back to bed and don't bring it up. And then the show comes around on Friday and I'm like, I said that. And Mike will have already cut it. He'll have known.
Yes, of course. Absolutely. We are endlessly grateful, obviously. Yeah. And the show is going to continue, and we're going to, you know, find ways to go on. We are researching ways to continue to be produced. But but it will certainly not be the same. And we will miss Mike enormously. And we encourage any of you who are in New York to stalk him mercilessly.
I do think it's important to note that Mike is not just the guy who pushes record and then cuts things together. The sound and sensibility of the show has a lot to do with Mike's taste and Mike's instincts.
Thank you.
Absolutely. This is as much Mike's show as any of the rest of us, if not more. Mike is always going to be our producer emeritus, and as we've told him, as long as he allows us to, he will still provide our kicky music.
Well, I'm still in the bargaining stages of all this, and last I heard WNYC is a radio station.
That's true.
Last I heard, radio stations have studios where people speak into microphones, so I would say you've probably not heard the last of Mike Katzif on our show.
I think that's absolutely true. Yep. I continue to hope that the winds will one day blow Mike Katzif back to us. But
Hear.
When you hear the wind whisper through the leaves, he'll say, Katzif. Katzif.
God. So, we did want to say before I go off to press tour, where I'll be for the next 2 weeks, that, you know, we're awfully grateful, buddy.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, thank you. I just want to say thank you to, you know, the four of you doing almost 100 episodes with you guys. You know, I've just learned so much. I've learned so many new movies and books and TV shows. And one thing I always tried to do with this show was make it so if you didn't know the four of you and you didn't know what we were talking about, if you didn't know whatever reality TV show, it was still fun and interesting. And I hope that part continues. And, you know, I've said to you guys privately, I think at the point when we were creating this show, we were all looking for new ways to stretch and do something creative and do something that was like our own. And part of that was we just decided to do it. When we did the first couple, we need to just keep doing this because eventually it's going to become something great. You know, that chemistry was there immediately. And if you listen to those first 10 episodes, they're rough and they're, you know, they're rambling, but there's something there. And I think, you know, we have such a devoted fan audience that, you know, that means a lot. It means that people are listening and caring. And so I want to thank you all and thank the fans. And hopefully I'll be able to kind of pop in every once in a while.
You bet. Yeah. You bet.
Please do.
We pretty much demand it. Absolutely. Whenever anybody says to me, like, there's lots of pop culture shows with people talking, but I like yours. I like the way it sounds. I always say, well, that's Mike.
Because so, don't really ramble as much as some of the...
Yeah, I would say, yeah, there's less stammering. And so, yeah, that's Mike. He cuts those out. So we're awfully grateful, bud. And we hope to have you back very soon. And that is... It's easy to point out that that is not what's making any of us happy this week.
Nope.
But...
It was a hard decision to
make. Yeah. Well, you will be missed, but you will also be welcome back anytime. And we hope to hear from you a lot. And, you know, Mike's still part of the family.
And
that's
Mike,
how
and
I'm
Mike
looking
will,
at it.
Absolutely. And Mike will be auditioning friends in New York City.
That's true. So if you need, like, an awesome new friend, Kansas bred, like, have we
must
got...
Love a, KU basketball.
Must love KU basketball. Yeah. Have we got a guy for you, New York? Our loss is your gain. So we do want to soldier on to the last part of our show, which is what's making us happy this week. I'm going to kick it off because I'm a hero and I'm going to move us into our last segment in this most difficult of days with a very simple what's making me happy this week, which is a video that emerged of Nathan Fillion delivering a kiss to a woman who had donated $1,000 to charity in order to kiss Nathan Fillion, which sounds like a really goofy thing to do. And it is a goofy thing to do, except that Nathan Fillion, as I said on Twitter today, is better at being a famous person than anyone else that I currently can think of. And so, of course, when you watch the video, he sort of makes this very funny production out of it, gets this woman up there and he sort of sets her up and then he dances a little bit with her just so it kind of warm it up a little bit. And then he very deeply dips this woman and kisses her and then pauses a minute and then kisses her some more. And it's the kind of thing where if you give the person the peck, right, if she says, I want to kiss Nathan Fillion for $1,000, that's creepy, right? Because she paid $1,000 just to get up there and I stood by Nathan Fillion. Then it feels like commerce. She's paying for the story, you know? Yeah. She's paying for the fun. She's paying for the story. And so if you give her the best possible experience, the best possible story, the most possible fun that she can possibly have legally... then it ceases to be creepy. And I just think he's absolutely delightful. Every time he emerges in public, he's doing something I think is cool and fun. And, you know, I've talked a million times about the way he went back to One Life to Live after he was massively famous and did an appearance for them on their anniversary of their show. I just think he's the absolute best. And you should watch that video. And it's really, really cool and cute. So that's what's making me happy this week. Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
Well, first of all, I'm glad that I finally got on my ass and watched Breaking Bad. Too much standing around, not watching Breaking Bad. Saw a lovely concert over the weekend with Best Coast, a band I've talked about on this show before. Lovely reactions to the little softball update that we gave away last week.
Yes.
If you go to popculturehappyhour.wordpress.com, it's still available. You can read it.
It's awesome.
And finally, with Mike leaving, it's been difficult days. And I talk a lot about feel-good music, but I also talk a lot about feel-better music. You know, music that no matter how you're feeling, it'll just kick you up a notch. I've been completely just marinating in this new album coming out in September, where we'll put it on the site eventually, by a singer named Sarah Cahoone, S-E-R-A-C-A-H-O-O-N-E. Her first two records are available now for purchase. There's a song called Couch Song. If you try, just spend $1 and listen to Couch Song. It is just devastatingly
wonderful.
It's Joan
of Bedtime music.
Yeah, my kids have listened to it at bedtime. It's not that it's sleepy so much as that it's calming.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
She's wonderful. She's got
she
a record.
Wonderful.
She's got a record coming out in September called Deer Creek Canyon, but not out till September. So just soak up her self-titled record and an album she put out in 2008 called Only as the Day is Long.
Wonderful. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
The news from Comic-Con that Anthony Mackie, he of the Hurt Locker and the Adjustment Bureau and also Real Steel, has been cast in the sequel to Captain America. It's called Captain America, the Winter Soldier, and he is playing Falcon. So if maybe Glenn can fill in a little information about what that is. But I don't care about the character, frankly. I care about Anthony Mackie, who I think is one of the most talented young actors working in film right now.
And underutilized in almost everything in which he appears.
In almost everything. I hope he makes bank on this.
You bet. You know, before we sent him off to New York with best wishes, and he'll be here next week, just I won't. Mike Katzef, why don't you tell us what's making you happy this week?
Sure. So I'm going to follow up with more Comic-Con news, because that was a huge thing that happened this weekend, and it seems more and more that comics are less a part of it, except that now with Marvel's success and the Avengers' success and all of this stuff, the big news that came out of that world was Marvel announcing their slate of upcoming movies, which they're calling Phase 2. Mm-hmm. You know, if everything before the Avengers is leading up to that, then this is sort of expanding that world. And so Trey said there's a new Captain America, there's a new Thor. There's a new movie called Guardians of the Galaxy, which I think kind of goes into the space. The best news, though, out of all this is they finally announced Ant-Man, which is awesome for many reasons. A, Ant-Man is one of the kookier characters in Marvel's stable of characters. Very 1960s. He's a guy. He's a scientist who discovers something called Pym particles. His name is Henry Pym. So he can shrink himself down. Later on, it's not giving anything away. These stories have gone on since the 1960s. He can grow himself to become Giant Man at some point. So he can grow and shrink. So this movie has sort of been rumored for quite a while. And it's exciting, really, though, because Edgar Wright has been attached to it forever.
Oh, nice.
Edgar Wright of Spaced.
Scott
Edgar
Pilgrim,
Wright of Scott Pilgrim, Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz. All of these movies, he's writing it and has been writing with Joe Cornish, who did Attack the Block.
Oh, wow.
Also awesome. And what can
cool
I say? They don't have any casting attached to it. It's not coming until 2014, probably, but this is going to be awesome. And it's going to be Honey, I Shrunk the Kids meets superheroes, and it's going to be rad.
So. Excellent. Thank
Nerds.
You. Thank you.
Unite.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Mike Katzef. Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week? Bring us home.
Well, that is a lot. But also, you know, I've been thinking that I've been projecting the wrong sort of image in terms of my gamer profile. I've been talking a lot about these superhero games and these games with the Joyce DeWitt and the headbands, and I just wanted to establish that I am an old school hardcore gamer. I got mad skills, as the kids say. Said. Like 15 years ago. So I just want to make sure that we kind of correct that mistaken impression. And in that vein, Lego Batman 2 is awesome. This great, where you play a little tiny little Lego guy and you have to kind of swing through a little tiny Lego version of Gotham City and kind of put things together, and you get all these different suits. It's filled with cameo appearances from all kinds of different characters. And the one cool thing about it is it's so cute because there was dialogue in this thing, but basically each character is a tiny little Lego version and they impart character by movement. There's sort of like a weird mime element to this where they kind of distill a character to his or her essence by just how little Lego guy moves. It's awesome.
Wow. That is wonderful.
I just find those games so incredibly. Is there a Duplo Batman
there
that I could
not.
Play to sort of get acquainted
there
with?
There is not. There is, if you have any obsessive compulsive tendencies, there's just, part of this game is just knocking the crap out of furniture until it gives up all these little Lego dots forever.
Well, thank you, Glenn Weldon, for telling us what's making you happy this week. You should all, of course, come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH and tell us what's making you happy this week. That brings us to the end of our show. I got all the way through the show without crying. Go me.
Yay.
You can find all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn Weldon at GH Weldon, WELDON. 10. You can follow our esteemed producer and friend for life, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music and always will, and you are listening to it right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you again. Well, these guys will see you again next week. I will be at Press Tour, but I'll be back.